It is 9:28 a.m. on Thursday, April 16th, 2020. This is lecture number one for the Echo High School philosophy course. The lecture is titled Metaphysics and Technics. A few words prior to diving in. It could easily be inferred that I am using these big words to show off and to impress. But to show off and impress whom? Myself? Big ego? No. I can tell you that I'm going to offer you an account today that refutes that, and I hope you take me at my word that I'm being authentic and genuine. The reason I'm using the words metaphysics and technics is because the two philosophers I have asked you to engage this week, Aristotle and Lewis Mumford, two very different people from very different times and incredibly different cultures, and yet they are very similar in many ways, they are attached to those words. Now, metaphysics. What comes to mind? Just ask yourself for a moment. What comes to mind when you hear that word? For me, because of my degree and my engagement with Aristotle in the past, philosophical ideas come to mind. Memories of reading a book. Metaphysics, theta 1 through 3. I have a lot of experience with this. So I recall arguments. I recall the books themselves. And I have to understand as a teacher that other people might say, oh, metaphysics, aren't those crystal shops? With, salt rock lamps and metaphysics books, like self-help, spiritualism, things like that. And the truth is that if that's what comes to their mind, then that's something that we have to take into consideration, because there are certain ideas that are in people's minds when it comes to these words. But in this case, I am telling you that I'm using that word because the first thing that I asked you to read came from Aristotle's Metaphysics, Book 1. Now, a little bit of fun. Two things. One, whereas philosophy is often understood as people using big words to show off at cocktail parties and to elevate themselves above everybody else in the room by trying to demonstrate that they are smarter and that they can grasp things that most others can't. I am coming out right up front and saying that philosophy cannot afford to be snobby. That is my strong opinion. Using big words to impress, to me, takes me completely, when I engage other people doing that, it totally takes me out of the game. And I don't really want to engage with them anymore, because to me, that is a slippery slope toward laziness and not caring about trying to develop a deep, authentic understanding of whatever idea is set in front of us, whatever we are trying to engage, whatever we are trying to access and develop a deeper understanding. So I personally believe that it is very important to use our language to make clear the idea that confronts us, the concept that confronts us, the questions that we are playing with. Otherwise, we're just kind of jerks who are trying to inflate our own egos and show off to others. The next point that I want to make about that is that somebody who I care about very deeply made commentary on my first, on the introductory lecture for this course, this philosophy course. And the first thing they said that made me feel good, but, you know, like I could move beyond that statement very quickly, was that the presentation was excellent. And while I sort of disagree, I tend to be fairly self-conscious when it comes to putting these things out. You know, that made me feel good. But the real engagement came with the follow-up when they said, but there's one caveat. There's one thing that I want you to think about. And this person said that they have, you know, two grandchildren, and that one of those grandchildren would be able to hang with the content of the lecture. You know, a very scholarly, academically inclined person, but that the other grandchildren has a lot of academic challenges. And this person said that they worried that this course and the content of the course would probably be alienating to the person with the academic challenges, and that I should be aware of that, and that, you know, that I should think about whether or not this, some of this stuff will fly over the heads of some people. Now, that is a fascinating thing to think about. And on the one hand, if, you know, let's say, like, fortunately, I wasn't. It was a very good conversation that helped me wrap my head around how to approach this course. Fortunately, you know, that person said, in response, I think, to the fact that I am doing a lot of this in audio, they said, remember, you know, broadcasters are often told when they're covering the news or whatever to deliver at an eighth grade level. So you might want to keep that in mind. That's what they told me. And I thought, that is a fascinating point. And I think that that statement is an excellent analogy to the challenge we face in the education system today. And I thought to myself, okay, let me marinate in that. If you remember that from the first lecture, I talked about basking in an idea and giving it the time to really sink in so that we can develop genuine positions and arguments. And by arguments, it doesn't mean yelling and shouting at somebody. It means you're putting forth evidence and facts and using rhetoric, using language, using symbols to be able to communicate your standing on an issue, to anchor it in something with substance and that makes sense for the purpose of persuasion. And I thought to myself, you know what? You're right. The last thing that I want this class to do is alienate and make people feel bad. That is a very truthful admission for me. I don't want to do anything that's going to make somebody avoid or run out the door. That said, there is a key difference that I latched on to when I heard that, and I thought, well, you know, for broadcasting and for news and, you know, for newspapers, news coverage, I can understand why they say shoot for that eighth grade, you know, comprehension target so that the average eighth grader could understand what's being said in the media. That makes sense. But in this case, I can tell you that the course is designed to do many things, but one of those things is to give 11th and 12th graders an experience that approximates college, that approximates what it means to sit in a 200 or 300 level philosophy course. Now, do all people need to go to college? Do all people need to take philosophy courses? Those questions are legitimate. I'm sure that some people would ask me that, but that I'm not going down that road. I am simply saying that in this case, whereas in news coverage and broadcasting, the eighth grade level argument makes sense, it does not make sense for an 11th and 12th grade level course. It is my job to ensure that prior to graduation, the students who opt into that course get an appropriately rigorous experience where they are confronted with material that does give that student a sense of what they would be asked to do if they went to the University of Oregon, Lane Community College, and took courses like these. That said, I have a deep sensitivity and awareness of both sides of the spectrum, which opens up another question related to the education system. And we have to talk about this because if we are going to discuss philosophy, and if we are going to embark on a journey that leads to an understanding of what philosophy is and what it does and how it connects to the human experience, then we have to be very much aware of the context in which this philosophical experience exists. And that is a high school, in this case, an alternative high school. I am speaking directly to my students when I say these things. And I want the school to be aware of what happens in the course. I want my students' families, guardians, friends, to be counselors, mentors, to be aware, if it is relevant to them, of what I'm asking the student to do so that we can all hold ourselves accountable to do our jobs. And with that, the final comment prior to launching into the material, a cursory breakdown of the material and also a sneak preview of what's coming up on this this upcoming Monday. I want to say that this course is deliberately designed both for the TAG student, the talented and gifted, in other words, which is a group, by the way, that is severely ignored in public education. And that this is a problem that has existed for decades. And I am proud that our district is very aware of the fact that many of our students who can function and at a higher level, than some of their peers, they are oftentimes asked to just kind of, we can't push that hard. We can't push forward because then we leave everybody else behind. But what I'm trying to say right now is that this course is very sensitive to the talented and gifted students. Oh, labels. And students receiving special education services. Students with barriers to success, students who are deserving of additional support. And I can tell you that there is very little that separates those two groups, and there is a great deal that unites them. I also want to point out that this course is not simply designed for the talented and gifted and students with, receiving special education services, additional supports to be successful, but it's designed for those of us living in between. We all have issues. Some of those issues cause difficulties. Other issues cause, successes. We're all over the map. We all have our issues. I am not one who can be trusted with difficult numbers-oriented tasks. If somebody says, oh, give this person a call, and I say, oh, what's their number? I cannot hold on to that phone number. The area code, the three digits for the area code, and then the next three digits, and then the hyphen, and then the four. My mind does not retain that stuff. I have to write that stuff down. Some people can look at the world and they see numbers. They are just mathematically minded people. And with that said, in this philosophy course, we all owe it to one another to attempt to gain an understanding of how each individual in the course learns, and to do our best to make sure that we are all coming away with a common understanding, even though that understanding will be acquired in different ways. So that said, philosophy cannot afford to be snobby, and I do not wish for this course to exclude anyone. Continuing on. I am an auditory learner. In response to the first or the second assignment, I should say, the two reading excerpts, the first from Aristotle's Metaphysics and the second from Lewis Mumford, actually taken from some of his notes that were uploaded to PDF online. And, you know, the notes come from his book, The Myth of the Machine, Volume 2, The Pentagon of Power, one of the most powerful books of philosophy I've ever read. I asked students to write responses to those excerpts. And while the excerpts are relatively short, especially with Aristotle, very much incomplete, that journey he goes on trying to unpack his ideas go on for pages upon pages upon pages, that I felt was not necessary for you to engage all the way through. A student wrote in response to Aristotle's Metaphysics, the first passage made a lot of sense in the beginning. It starts getting confusing toward the end. I thought it put into perspective why and how everyone is different, which is super important to know when speaking about or working on something subjective or just navigating the world. I liked what was said or written about how experience is knowledge, or rather knowledge comes from experience. But then the person continues on and says, but otherwise I couldn't tell what the meaning or main point was, other than to give a breakdown of how our view or bias toward knowledge, and gaining it. I don't know if we're supposed to know who Paulus and Callias are. I haven't heard of them. I have heard the name Socrates, but still know next to nothing about him. I also admittedly didn't know what he was talking about when he spoke about disease in the last paragraph. Really connected with a lot of it, though. I love the fact that this student's response covered what was understandable and acknowledged what was not understandable, because that student did not have experience with what with the two names that Aristotle used there. Talking about Paulus, one of the reasons this student doesn't know Paulus is because Paulus died about 2,300 years ago. There's a philosopher named Plato who had a very eccentric, crazy teacher who did not like taking showers or wearing shoes. In 399 BC, in reality, Athens, which was their city, their government condemned Socrates to death for his teachings. We're going to get into that later on in the term. But in terms of setting the stage, basically Aristotle is expecting that the reader is going to know who those two people are. And for a long time, and especially in Aristotle's context, people really did know. These were pretty famous people. Paulus was one who believed that rhetoric, which is language, you know, it's connected to language and how we use it, believed that rhetoric was, to quote from Wikipedia, the quick route to the life of a tyrant who can run over others and escape punishment for his crimes. Paulus saw rhetoric as the highest of all human arts and thinks that rhetoric is the only knowledge one needs to live well. And then when it comes to Callias, Callias was an incredibly rich person who lived back then in the times of Plato and Aristotle. And we're going to unpack what he said and did as well. But he was seen as kind of an evil, rich genius. And by the end of his life, because of the way that he lived and the way he behaved, the way he betrayed several people, the way that he chose to spend his time and his resources, he ended up suffering a massive downfall by the end of his life and was completely penniless and destitute. Now, what does this have to do with philosophy? Well, I believe that philosophy is concerned with what it means to live wisely. Living wisely and having a knowledge and having experience of what it means, what it feels like, and what it looks like to live wisely can help us avoid some of those massive downfalls. It can help us avoid some of our more tyrannous tendencies, going back to Paulus. And, you know, Paulus was trying to argue that humans are people who, if we are not careful, can be pretty base, nasty creatures. And when it comes right on down to it, another point that I'm getting at, which is going to be an invitation to the Mumford piece, deals with what it means for civilizations to decline and fall. Here in the 21st century, we are talking about a very specific context, and there are a lot of things that separate us from a 4th century Athenian philosopher. 2,400 years. Think about all the things that are different. Our technologies are very different. Our ability to see the world, our ability to learn, like there's a lot of differences, but also too, there are many similarities. Aristotle, his book, starts out by saying, "All human beings by nature stretch themselves out toward knowing." And I believe that that is, that's true. That's something that many of us could agree with. You know, a sign of this is our love of the senses, for even apart from their use, they are loved on their own account. And above all the rest, the one through the eyes. For not only in order that we might act, but even when we are not going to act at all, we prefer seeing, one might say, as against everything else. And the cause is that among the senses, this one most of all makes us discover things and makes evident many differences. By nature, then, the animals come into being having sense perception, though in some of them memory does not emerge out of this, while in others it does. What Aristotle is doing here is making a statement that says, okay, we can all agree on this. All human beings by nature stretch themselves out toward knowing. But what about all beings? What is the difference between human beings and the rest of the beings? What is the difference between a lion and a human? What responsibilities come along with owning that humanity, with having that, with being a part of the human culture? Another major thing that we need to keep in mind is that humans, in terms of corruption, in terms of being easily tempted by tyranny, easily seduced by the promise of power and wealth, power over others, whether it is using our rhetoric or using our money or using our physical strength or using our societal standing. Human beings have a responsibility to keep themselves in check, and that means that they have to have a sense of what they are capable of so that they have a say in making the decision of how they are going to live in relation to others, other humans, other non-humans, and how they are going to live in harmony with the world, with nature. If we destroy nature, we destroy the context that allows us to live and thrive. If we destroy certain elements of the world, then and we get out of balance in terms of the natural balance that we have to strike with the world, then we run a serious risk of destroying our ability to live wisely and live well. And this course, it's very timely right now to be asking ourselves some questions as the entire world just by and large hit the pause button on almost all human activities. We can't go to restaurants right now, by and large, pretty much anywhere in the world. We can't really do much of any, we can't go to school. We can't do much of anything but go to the grocery store and figure out a way to adapt to this new situation in the hope that we can return to some kind of normalcy. But the philosophical mind in this context is going to start asking questions, okay, moving forward, what do we need to take into consideration so that we don't recreate this bad situation? What can we do as we move forward to improve and to ensure that we don't make these same mistakes again? And how can we transmit that to future generations so that they are living more wisely than we are? Next, I'm going to say a little bit about Mumford and the little excerpt that I gave you to read, only very few lines. And then as I'm coming up on the 30-minute mark, I am going to stop and remind everybody that my office hours are 10 o'clock a.m. to 11 o'clock a.m. every day, 12:30 p.m. to 1:30 p.m. every day, and by appointment. Please reach out to me at my district email, bjornstedt_t@4j.lane.edu. And remember that all assignments for every week are due on Saturday at 11:59 p.m. Now, Mumford said on page 3, "With this new megatechnics, the dominant minority will create a uniform, all-enveloping, superplanetary structure designed for automatic operation. Instead of functioning actively as an autonomous personality, man will become a passive, purposeless, machine-conditioned animal whose proper functions as technicians now interpret man's role, will either be fed into the machine or strictly limited and controlled for the benefit of depersonalized collective organizations." Whew. Now, student that I referenced earlier said of the Mumford thing, quote, "The second one was just unsettling. I don't know what megatechnics means, but I really don't want to look it up after reading the rest of the paragraph. Sounds like some dystopian Mars factory thing that only the top 1% will ever benefit from. I mean, megatechnics might not be a bad thing, but the language they use is definitely making it come across that way. I failed to grasp onto a meaning of some sort from this, though. Could mean the end of humanity as we know it. I'm really not sure. Not sure I want to know." And that is where I am going to end this. I love that response. The openness to the openness to being able to say, there are certain things that are kind of creepy about that. I'm not sure I want to know it. I'm not sure I want to look it up. I don't completely grasp it. But I sense that there is something heavy there that deserves to be unpacked. So please, the rest of you students who have not yet engaged these two excerpts, do so by Saturday so that next week we can proceed. I was originally going to post up another piece for the end of this week, but I'm going to forget that. I just want to make sure that as many students as possible engage those two excerpts and send a document with your thoughts and responses to it. Questions. What do you understand? What do you not? Do you like it? Do you not? Please do that. And in closing, I'm going to read a bit from a philosopher we will tackle later on in the term, Martin Heidegger, and from his The Question Concerning Technology because I believe that he very well defines, maybe I should say explains, what philosophy does and how it works. In what follows, we shall be questioning concerning technology. Questioning builds a way. We would be advised, therefore, above all, to pay heed to the way, and to not fix our attention on isolated sentences and topics. This is where I'm going to stop, because I just hit the 30-minute mark. Thank you for listening to this, folks. I know that some of it is very dense. The purpose of this little recording was not to totally unpack and make clear those excerpts yet. That's still an assignment, and you still have 3 more days to engage them. But the purpose was to authentically communicate to you that I am honored and happy that you have decided to take this course, and that I promise you that though it starts with engaging some somewhat difficult material, I'm only going to give you small exposures and doses to those big ideas. And the whole point of this course is to take those big, somewhat daunting ideas and to reduce them down to a level of genuine clarity so that we can all walk away from this course feeling more confident in our abilities and aware that we are capable of asking tough questions. Okay, I will speak more on Monday, and since this recording is 31 minutes 48 seconds as of this moment right now, please subtract 2 minutes from the work that you do either tomorrow, Friday, or Saturday. Take care, folks. Stay safe.